Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more and either presenting or just attending the forum, text the word THINGS, that's THINGS, to the number 345-345 on your cell phone. That's THINGS to 345-345. You can also point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more, to submit an abstract for a talk, or to register. Welcome back to another episode of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief and publisher at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode, number 88, cybercrime is growing by leaps and bounds. But what do cybercriminals do with all their ill-gotten gain? You might be surprised to find out when we talk to criminologist Dr. Mike McGuire of the University of Surrey about research he's done on the tools that online criminal groups use to launder their money. But first, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security joined the FBI last week in issuing a joint technical alert that highlighted the danger posed by Russian hackers to U.S. critical infrastructure. That announcement accompanied new sanctions from the Treasury Department against prominent Russians with links to incidents like the NotPetya malware outbreak, intrusions at companies that operate U.S. critical infrastructure, and online meddling in the U.S. presidential election. The group in question, which is known as Dragonfly, has been on the radar of security industry firms since at least 2014. In this first segment of our podcast, we invited Vikram Thakur of the firm Symantec back into the studio. I start out by asking Vikram to tell us what Symantec knows about the Dragonfly Group.
My name is Vikram Thakur. I'm a technical director with Symantec Security Response. Dragonfly is a group of hackers or offensive attackers, as you can see, in cyberspace, who started operating way back a few years ago, and Symantec actually wrote about them publicly back in 2014. And the aim over there of theirs was to infiltrate some of the organizations in the industrial space, or should we say in the manufacturing space, and try to steal information about throughput, about what the organization was using in terms of technology, and what the configuration was across their network. When Symantec published about them a few years ago, almost immediately they kind of went off the radar, and this is not very uncommon because every time a group gets outed, they kind of fall back a little bit, try to retool, try to figure out how to evade detection in the future, and then start their campaigns all over again. And this happened with Dragonfly as well. So in early 2016, Dragonfly sort of reemerged, trying to attack energy companies in the Western world, the United States included. But they were really on a fact-finding mission, it appeared, because once they would get onto networks, what we saw them doing was really just looking for documentation, trying to figure out if they could steal some information about how the networks within energy companies were configured, what kind of equipment they were using, what kind of contractors they might have. But anything that you would find on one's corporate network is what they were initially looking for. And that kind of went on for a while. And in a small number of cases, we did see Dragonfly hop on to what we term as the operational technology network.
For the listeners' benefit, we're really talking about two different types of networks here. One is the just kind of general corporate network, kind of similar to the networks that are at most of our workplaces. And then, but these infrastructure operators and manufacturers and so on have these operational networks. And what types of systems are on those, Vikram?
You're correct, Paul. I mean, there is what we term as the corporate network, which is where executives, staff, finance, human resources, and generally most employees of any company would sit and work at. And then there is the industrial network. And this, think of this as the network which comprises of hardware, gas pipelines, conveyor belts, anything industrial related. All those components reside on the industrial side. And that network is typically called the Operational Technology Network or the OT network. Now, normally the OT network does not communicate with the internet directly. I mean, it's very rare for a manufacturing company to have their OT network somehow directly connected to the internet. In most cases, the OT network is only connected to the corporate network through a bridge, and the corporate network is, of course, connected to the internet, just the way all of us work in our own offices every day. Mm-hmm. So for an attacker to get onto the OT network, they first need to hack into the company's corporate network, then figure out where that little bridge exists to cross over to the OT network. And so it's very different from just simply attacking a company and trying to steal their financial information. In the case of trying to attack an industrial or a critical infrastructure company, you need to get onto corporate networks, then pivot over to the operational technology network. And once over there, it is extremely difficult for one to start learning about the configuration of hardware over there. Now, think about an oil refinery. Now, an oil refinery has tons and tons of different components in their network, from steam pipes to intake valves to controllers, which are controlling the amount of oil coming into a certain segment of their refinery. Now, there are computers which are connected to all this hardware to be able to control which valve to open, which valve to close, or in an emergency, what action needs to be taken automatically, rather than rely upon humans to come in and try to, you know, turn a valve. Computers have been programmed to take certain action at certain times of operation. An attack against industrial computers ends when an attacker is able to get access to these computers, understand the impact that would happen when certain valves are turned on or off, or switches are turned on or off, and then is successfully able to make that kinetic change, which will cause some level of destruction or downtime for that industry itself.
And this most recent alert included a screenshot that the government had kind of pieced together. It looked like the kind of schematic of a industrial facility showing all the different types of pieces. This is probably from a HMI system, human machine interface system. Would that seem to indicate that they were going that next step to, first of all, understand and then presumably influence the operation of those mechanical systems?
I think the image that DHS was able to share with the rest of the world really indicates that the attackers were in that learning phase where they wanted to gather information by taking screenshots of machines which had such kind of schematics displayed on their computer. The attackers can take that back to home base and show it to other experts that might understand it a lot better. It's key to understand that in such kind of attacks, there has to be a synergy between people who are technically smart in cyberspace versus people who are also smart in terms of understanding how these networks and components all work together.
And in their alert this week, Department of Homeland Security and FBI indicated that this was a group that was interested in many different types of organizations, aviation, energy, other manufacturing, and so forth. Has that always been true of this Dragonfly group, or is that new that they have expanded not just to include energy and the electric grid, for example, but these other sensitive verticals as well?
I think it's relatively new that the Dragonfly group has sort of expanded their operations beyond energy. But even with their attacking of different sectors or different verticals, we still believe that their core interest was in the energy sector itself. It's very likely that they were attacking these other sectors with the aim of finding that stepping stone into the right location within the energy industry to be able to influence some change. We make that analytical deduction based on the number of energy companies that got targeted versus the number of companies in these other verticals that were at the receiving end of Dragonfly.
I mean, one thing when you read the report that this group clearly does is to target downstream business partners, third parties that are customers or partners, again, of the ultimate target, these critical infrastructure operators, and attack those companies as a way to pivot to the ultimate target. How common is that with these types of advanced persistent threat groups? And as the company or organization that might be the ultimate target, what can you really do about that if it's not your network that's going to be targeted, at least initially, but some of these smaller organizations that you do business with?
It's a very good question. I mean, at the end of the day, the target organizations, or every organization, should look at their vendors, their partners that they're allowing access to within their own network with a level of skepticism, saying, asking those vendors to also have a security posture which matches the maturity of the larger organization itself. We've seen over the past decade a lot of companies doing that and forcing their vendors to spend a lot more on their own security of the network in order to do things much better and reduce the risk for the larger organizations. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, it is a problem where smaller vendors are being targeted so that they can provide that little stepping stone into the larger organization. This is not new. We have tons of different APT groups which do the exact same thing. And it is a well-known technique in the industry. So we know for a fact that the large organizations are looking at that as one infiltration point.
When you look at some of the data that the Department of Homeland Security released on these attacks, you know, what surprised me, and maybe a little bit depressing as well, is how unoriginal or unremarkable the attacks and the bait were. You know, where you got the job interview with the attached resume as a Word document, you know, and the malware is in the Word document and that type of thing. These seem like pretty straightforward attack methodologies, but why do they continue to work on these organizations that know that they're being targeted?
I want to give the organization some sort of credit, because in a large number of cases, we know that not all these techniques actually applied or were not as successful as the DHS alert actually makes them out to be. I mean, the DHS alert is a culmination of information from different organizations, different attacks. But to your underlying question about why does this level of attacker sophistication still work? I mean, sophistication is kind of a poor word to even use out there, but the fact of the matter is, in a lot of these organizations, security was not the primary mandate when the organizations were designed and they came up. I mean, these organizations were core to a completely different business model, and their networks were designed in a way just to make things work easily, and they were never under the gun for a long period of time. But that's changing. I mean, we see, we speak with a lot of different organizations, and we can see that there's genuine interest in upping their own levels of protection and defense. So while such kind of reports are always a little disheartening to know that a foreign government is trying to infiltrate your critical infrastructure, if there is a silver lining, it is that the defensive posture of a large majority of our critical infrastructure organizations gets upped due to such incidents. Mm. And it's a good thing that we've not seen any serious damage happen as a result of this infiltration also. I mean, the attackers either were not motivated enough to cause any kinetic harm or were unable to get into a position of doing so.
I mean, we have seen examples in Saudi Arabia of cyberkinetic attacks, or at least attackers laying the groundwork for cyberkinetic attacks, you know, with the Trisys or Triconix malware. Should U.S. owners, operators of manufacturing facilities, electric grids, critical infrastructure, be concerned that similar attacks might be coming their way?
Well, I think the critical infrastructure operators within the United States are already well aware that, hey, at least from a technical standpoint, these kind of attacks can happen, and they're no longer just theoretical. They're very well aware of that, and they are taking steps towards preventing something like that happening in their own network. What really is missing, or what is usually out of their control, is the political motivation. I mean, they don't know whether a foreign adversary would be politically motivated to affect that change even after getting the technical expertise or the technical chops to reside in their networks and make that change. But you're right. I mean, operators in our space are already concerned about it and are taking steps towards bettering their own networks against such kind of attacks.
So you've been tracking these folks since 2014. And obviously, we've seen an increase in activity in the last, you know, year and a half. Where do things go from here? Should we expect to see a continued escalation of these types of activities? Or is there kind of a probing going on and maybe they kind of woke the bear up and things are going to quiet down?
We have no doubt that this group is not going to go away. They're going to continue their operations. They will regroup after maybe a few weeks, a few months of downtime, but they will continue their operations and trying to penetrate different verticals, maybe continue going down the energy route, but they will try to create that little access that can be used as leverage by people in power if the need ever arises.
Vikram Thakur, thank you so much for coming in and talking again to the Security Ledger podcast. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Up next, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin got an early boost from adoption by online criminals. Soon, Bitcoin was the coin of the realm for underground black markets where patrons purchased weapons, stolen identities, and more. But cryptocurrencies are just one of many tools that cybercriminals can use to cash out. Our next guest, Dr. Mike McGuire of the University of Surrey in the UK, says that cybercriminals have no shortage of tools these days for turning stolen goods into cold hard cash. Among them, trade in virtual goods on gaming platforms like the World of Warcraft. In this conversation, Professor McGuire talks about the research that he did with the help of the firm Bromium to examine online money laundering activity. I started by asking him to explain to us how most cyber criminal loot gets laundered.
My name is Dr. Michael McGuire, and I'm a senior researcher in criminology at the University of Surrey in the UK. Well, you've got two basic routes. One is what would be referred to as traditional laundering methods. And it's been interesting looking at this question of how prepared cyber criminals are to use very well-established methods of laundering, you know, that the mafia would have recognized back in the 1950s and, you know, beyond into the 1930s. And that would include things like casino laundering, like the creation of shell companies, like the creation of use of mules, you know, human beings to transport money around, either wittingly or unwittingly, and to straightforward wire transfers. You know, there's a huge amount of money being moved around by people like Western Union. So these people are good at finding gaps in the system that already exists out there. But of course, on top of this, they've now got a whole new digital payment and transaction infrastructure, which has emerged in the last 10 years or so, from the use of cryptocurrencies, through digital payment systems like PayPal, through mobile payment systems, and so on. You know, so they've got the benefit of being able to use the new digital payment approaches to launder and the old systems, and very often they use them in combination.
Cryptocurrencies obviously have been greatly assistive to these cyber criminals in moving money and also laundering it. Talk about what change the advent of these cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin have had in the last 5 or 6 years since they've emerged and really taken hold globally.
There's all sorts of debates, and when I've spoken to law enforcement about this, there are big questions about what kind of problem cryptocurrencies really pose in criminal terms. And the general view amongst most law enforcement and academic researchers as well is that the use of cryptocurrencies is still fairly small compared to traditional laundering methods. And the one fairly reliable statistic tells us there's around about 4% of global laundered money is in the form of cryptocurrencies, which, you know, if you take the UN figure as accurate of laundering, it's come to about something like about 40 to 80 billion worth of dollars going around in cryptocurrency. So, I mean, the landscape has been clearly, you know, since the late 2010 onwards, we saw a lot of evidence in cyber crimes around that phase that cyber criminals very, very quickly latched onto Bitcoin as the dream medium, really, both to receive payments and then once they've received payments to move it around. So, I mean, you know, probably one of the most famous busts in recent years that everyone will know about is the Silk Road heist. I believe that Ross Ulbricht, you know, who's the guy that the Feds nailed for that, they found something like about $2 billion in Bitcoin that they confiscated from him. A lot of the early scam, whereas that or the sheep market or the farmers market, a lot of these big sites that used Bitcoin as a way of paying money, or even crimeware sites, really that set the scene for the, I would say, from 2010 onwards to about where we are now. The big shift now is that people are beginning to move away from Bitcoin because, you know, everyone's talking about it, and criminals don't like to be involved in things that people talk about very much. So you'll have seen from probably the press release, you know, that the other currencies like Zcash and Monero are the big ones they're moving towards now.
Now, some of these are pinned. I think Monero is actually pinned to Bitcoin as a currency, but is, I guess, the attraction for cyber criminals is not the valuation of the currency itself, but rather the systems around it to protect their anonymity?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, of course, cyber criminals are no different from the rest of us. You know, they want the money they make, the value they've acquired, to be as stable as it possibly can be. And of course, Bitcoin is notoriously volatile at the moment. So they would prefer to invest their ill-gotten gains in much more sensible and stable forms. And, you know, there are ways that later in the report, when it comes out, you know, you'll see information about how they're spending. Interesting that they're actually quite good at investing money, cyber criminals. They're keeping their money by investing in objects, which is a form of laundering on one hand. Another form, it's also just sensible investment for the future. But
you mentioned that they're buying property, actually houses and villas and apartments with Bitcoin. Is that something you can do?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wasn't aware that was even possible.
There's a whole ecosystem out there of Bitcoin exchanges that if you happen to fancy a tropical island, Paul, just get yourself enough Bitcoin, you can go to several websites which will sell you anything from sports cars to tropical islands to villas in very nice locations, and you pay for it all directly in Bitcoin. So you can see the obvious possibilities there of an immediate conversion. You can do it offshore. You can do an offshore transaction. It doesn't go through the banking system. You convert your Bitcoin instantaneously into a concrete asset. And not only have you got something, perhaps you've invested, it's going to keep this money in the future, but you've also disappeared the money. So yeah, that's, you know, direct spending on items is one very common way in which laundering is done. And it's a mixture of laundering and just straightforward hedonistic acquisition.
You know, the buzz around Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is that they are truly anonymous. They're kind of like the digital equivalent of cash. You point out that in practice, that's not exactly true, that there are ways that regulators or law enforcement might be able to trace a particular Bitcoin transaction back to an individual or individuals.
That's absolutely the case. Yeah, it has been one of the big myths of Bitcoin. I think cyber criminals probably bought into this a little bit at first as well. The idea you could do completely anonymous transactions, and of course, in a sense, that's a contradiction, because the whole basis of Bitcoin is the idea of the blockchain, which is a visible and manifest account, ledger, that's spread across the web, but you can trace it back. So, you know, almost any kind of Bitcoin transaction, you find what the wallet is, and you find what's going into the wallet, and you can find out what's going out of the wallet. And some of the big, you know, for example, recent ransomware attacks, like the WannaCry attack. Which paralyzed so many systems around the world. People set up all kinds of apps, you know, that would simply just sit there and crawl across the web and watch what money was coming into ransomware wallets attached to WannaCry and watch where it was going. So it's completely transparent on that level. There are ways around that which people have adopted called mixers, which you may be familiar with, which are a way of taking the trails that the transactions on the blockchain create and mixing them up. So you kind of anonymize where they're coming from and where they're going to. It makes it much harder to find the link.
Kind of a way to lose yourself in the crowd, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just kind of move around very quickly. And it's kind of there's some analogies there with BitTorrents. You know, we just mix up the chains and then make it hard to follow. But you know, of course, people are not far behind on this, and there's a number of commercial companies in the UK. We've got a company called Elliptic who sit there and monitor these movements with virtual currencies. And I think in the States, there's a company called Chain Analysis. Now, you know, having spoken to law enforcement, a lot of these companies are actually almost working full time now for law enforcement. They're using them to track where stuff is going. And there's other research that's been done by people in Princeton, I believe, that have come across. They say a way of 60% of cases when people are using mixers of being able to find unique traces of who they are and then trace back the currency to them. So, you know, it's by no means a nirvana of complete disguise and anonymity on there. Of course, you know, it's still at least 50% of cases where you can't get a unique identification. And there are ways around this, and you mix up your currencies with other different types of currencies, and currencies like Monero are harder to do that with. So it is a dynamic and ever-changing system.
So one of the really interesting, in addition to the cryptocurrencies, I mean, one of the interesting things that you found was the use of gaming loot and gaming systems, whether it's World of Warcraft or FIFA, to both hide and launder ill-gotten gain. How does that work exactly? It's kind of incredible to think that these gaming systems and the little mini economies that exist within them might come to the attention of cyber criminals with money to launder.
Well, yeah. And again, you know, credit to the American financial systems there, because about 4 or 5 years ago, they looked at this and they defined gaming currencies as something which could be a laundering tool if they act as what they call money transmitters. Anything that can act as a money transmitter is going to be of interest to a criminal as a form of laundering. So when you've got, as you have in many gaming, whether it's Minecraft or World of Warcraft, you have got a way of cashing out items within the game that have value into another form, which also has value. If you can do that, if you can convert it out of the game into the real world, then you've got a perfect mechanism. So, I mean, this idea has been out there. I mean, there was some interesting research done by a chap working for the UN a few years ago who sort of noticed that this might be something that might be happening. It's very, very much under the radar. I mean, I did a lot of digging around into this, trying to find out what I could. At the moment, it seems to be something that, as far as we can tell, is going on more in the Far East. You know, there's a whole series of stories about, you know, people in China buying currencies in Korea and then converting those into yen and then being transmitted back into China over the border as cash. It's definitely going on. The scale of it is very, very hard to ascertain, and you just have to pick up what you can on hacker forums and other people. And the buzz is out there that this is something the feds don't know about. The actual levels of it is something which it remains a mystery at this point, but it's obvious, really, isn't it? Because up until this point, the police, law enforcement, so have not been looking at they haven't got time to look at what goes on in every sort of forum, you know. And it might not be a currency in the game. Of course, there's other objects that have value in these games, you know, whether they're magical swords or gold or anything that, you know, is of value to other gamers that gamers are willing to pay for. And of course, this has now been made much, much easier by the advent in the last few years of in-app purchases, where a hell of a lot of games are based around the idea that you have to buy things to be able to progress. Now, with that kind of liquidity between the gaming environment and the external world, I mean, you know, it's just, again, it's absolutely opened it up. And there's all kinds of stuff I picked up on the wires of people buying commodities, sometimes buying currencies. And as you say, you know, you might purchase that with some Bitcoin wallet. You might go to one of these big factories that they have in Southeast Asia, where people work for hours and hours on end to generate enough experience points to be able to purchase things. That in itself has got value, you know, the points that you generated to be able to do things. So the value, the only crucial thing is the value and what can be exchanged. And gaming environments just have got so many aspects like that, which
You mentioned it only around 4% of the laundering right now globally involves cryptocurrencies, digital currencies. One question would be, why such a small percentage? Is it the technological barrier of getting onto and using these platforms, or are there other reasons?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, there is technological boundary, although, of course, cyber criminals are not going to be too worried about that. Even ones who haven't got skills themselves, who buy the skills from crime service online, we'll be able to find a way of acquiring the skills to do that. So there's perhaps the technical barrier is a small barrier, but not a big one. I think the answer really comes down to several factors. One is, there is so much money being laundered, and people just haven't appreciated just how much of the global economy is running on laundered money. One of the things that I talk about in the report, you'll see when it comes out, is the fascinating interrelations between what I'm calling the cyber economy and the legitimate economy. Increasingly, it's hard to evade the conclusion that these two things are interdependent. They feed off each other. You know, you have huge banks like HSBC, you have huge financial centers like the City of London and Wall Street, and the amount of money that's being laundered through these institutions is quite mind-boggling. So cyber criminals haven't quite got to that level yet. But in terms of criminal practice, a big influence, a second factor is money is always king because of the traceability and the non-traceability. If you can put $1,000 in somebody's underpants and put them on a plane to Zurich, you know, you're going to launder that money a lot more successfully. So the use of mules, the use of other laundering techniques is still by and large preferred because it's just easier to hide it. That will change. That is changing as the interdependence of these traditional and these contemporary ways of laundering becomes more pronounced. But at the moment, and this is why, you know, law enforcement have been relatively relaxed about this, saying, you know, we're not too worried yet because it's still fairly small compared to the big sums that are going around the world.
I guess that would be the next or final question, which is, you know, this cat and mouse between criminals seeking to launder their ill-gotten gain and either the IRS, you know, the revenue services or the authorities goes back, you know, I don't know, centuries really. I mean, it's almost a permanent fixture, but the digital currencies obviously and some of these electronic payment platforms are newer. Where are we in the cat and mouse scenario right now? Are the mice, as it were, proliferating, or are the regulators and authorities starting to get their arms around this and maybe catch or interrupt some of these payments and transactions?
That is a very important question. Criminologists talk about this arms race between criminals and law enforcement, and you're absolutely right. It's been there since the dawn of time. There before the advent of the police force in 1829, there was ways around it. What we see at this point in the cycle, we have to be a little bit careful that we, you know, don't go too far on either side and start coming with alarmist headlines. The police, law enforcement are a lot more on top of it than they're willing to let on. And, you know, when I have spoken to a lot of these people, and there's certain points in the conversation where the conversation goes dead. They won't say anything else. I mean, the example of how they're tracking virtual currency payments, I think they know that they're better at doing that than they've let us know, for good reasons, operational reasons. Some of the big busts that they've been in recent years, the InFraud bust that took place a few weeks ago, the BTCE bank that they got. These are big operations, and these involve a lot of cooperation between police forces. At the same time, one of the things about cybercrime that makes it different from any other criminal phenomenon in history is the volume that it's possible to generate. It's so easy for so many people to be involved and for people who are involved to do so much with so little. The mice, if they're the criminals, are swarming everywhere. And to get on top of that, I think, is about impossible for law enforcement to really get on top of it. I think they can shape and they can filter. And it's probably not so different from crime, you know, crime in the past. We don't have data about how much crime there was in the 1850s because we didn't collect that data. So it's really hard to be sure. So the fact that cybercrime is a globalized crime and you have centers of criminality, and, you know, Russia is the obvious one, but, you know, everywhere you look, there are centers of activity, and you can't reach those people very easily. You can't bust them.
Yeah.
I'm afraid at this point in history, while we shouldn't be alarmed, because law enforcement are on top of this in other ways, the volume, the global spread means that cyber criminals are definitely winning.
Dr. Mike McGuire, Senior Lecturer in Criminology at Surrey University, England, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on the Security Ledger about your research.
That was great to talk to you, Paul, and thanks very much for taking an interest in the work.